battalion, the Canadian Scottish, in the meantime had landed, and they moved on through the others, and they reached their first objective that night, and we moved on and spent the night at a place called Cui, I think it is, yes, which was it was about 6 kilometers in from the beach. We had a very peaceful night, and first thing next morning we moved on down to near Lettville Lagrieuse, and that's where we stayed for about 10 days, because in the meantime the German reinforcements, their counterattack forces had moved up, armored divisions, and they started pounding us, and we had 10 days of a very, very miserable time.
Third day you had a short vacation.
Yes, I had a short vacation. I was going back to the divisional headquarters, which was at Beni-sur-Mer, and going through a little wooded valley at the place near a little village called Fontaine-Henri, I should say that on the outskirts of the village, I met some Canadians who had just landed. It was a Provo unit who were setting up a prisoner of war cage, they called it. In other words, it was just a field, and they were setting up machine guns on the outside. And I spoke to the officer in charge. He was a lieutenant, German, and told him where I was going and where I was going, and asked him if he knew anything about that road. He said, "Oh, that's okay." So I took off in my Jeep. I only drove for about 5 minutes when I came to a barbed wire entanglement across the road, a concertina wire, and so I knew something wasn't right, and I started to back up to get out of there, and a machine gun opened up on me, and I bailed out into the ditch, and almost immediately there were two Germans on top of me, and they dragged me out, put me back in the Jeep, and said, "Drive on," which I did. And I just went around the corner up the hill, and there was a very large cave, an underground quarry, in which this unit were holed up. They had, on the hill above the cave, they had a perimeter defense with machine guns and mortars, and it was a very tough little position, and they had managed to withstand the invasion troops. They'd gone right past them, and here I was, and they already had about 20 prisoners. They had a number of wounded people and some of their own wounded. And so they put me in this cave where I spent the day. But in the meantime, the shooting started. Mortar shells started landing in the mouth of the cave, and it became more acute as the day went on, and the Germans became more and more agitated, until eventually the commanding officer came to me and said, "You're the senior officer among my prisoners, and I would like to surrender. We fought a good fight. We were surrounded. We have no hopes whatever of getting out of this." So I said, "Fine. Call in your troops and disarm them right here," which he did. I had a pile of German rifles and Schmeissers and various other weapons in front of me, and
did you speak German?
No. But these people, they were, I speak French, and they were garrison troops who had been in France for several years, and most of them spoke some French. The commander spoke very good French. And the shooting was pretty hot, and so I said, well, fine, but we have to stop the shooting before we can get out of here. And I said, you better have someone go out in front of the cave with a white flag. And so he detailed his junior officer to hold a white flag. And the junior officer said, well, no self-respecting German officer ever waves a white flag. But I was armed by then with a German weapon. And I said, well, you will wave a white flag. And he said, well, I don't have a white flag. And I said, well, there's a little hospital down here at the end of the cave, and they have white sheets, I see, and there are some long-handled shovels. Tie a white sheet on a shovel, and which he did, and he poked his head out of the cave with me right behind him, and he waved the white flag, and eventually the shooting stopped. So with the help of this, incidentally, the provost officer who had guided me had been taken prisoner in the meantime, along with his sergeant. Unfortunately, the sergeant was killed. But so with the two of us and a number of other British troops that were prisoners, we formed up these Germans outside the cave and marched them down to the road into the prison camp, the prison cage that was waiting for them. So that was the end of that episode. And the people who had been doing all the shooting was the Chaudière Regiment, the French-Canadian regiment from near Quebec City. And they had been given the task of mopping up, and they did a very good job mopping this up. Eventually, I went back up and got my Jeep, which had been put in the cave. And they had many vehicles underground. It was a very large cave, which had been a limestone quarry in the Middle Ages. In fact, there was one story that Westminster Abbey was built of limestone that came from that and similar caves in Normandy, which may well be. So I got my Jeep back and I finished my task. I eventually got to divisional headquarters and then back home that night. And I always remember Brigadier Foster and that occasion. He was beset by attacks from German tanks, some of which were threatening to break through, but he found time to worry about me. He was delighted when I pulled into camp. Thereon, you know the story of the European campaign as well as I do. We eventually Caen fell, and then Falaise, and then we made a big leap up to the Seine, where we had a bit of resistance crossing the Seine at a place called Elbeuf, just upstream from Rouen. Then the 3rd Division moved up to Boulogne and Calais, which had been left defended. As the German army withdrew, they had left very strong garrisons those two ports. Also, they have the Sandgat batteries, which consisted of 16-inch naval guns in reinforced concrete emplacements that were very useful in harassing shipping on the channel, because they were able to fire. They had a range of 25 or more miles. Well, they could fire all the way to Canterbury. After they had been destroyed, they were badly bombed with heavy bombers, and then one of the brigades, I think it was the 8th Brigade, maybe it was our brigade, I've forgotten, attacked them, and as these big guns were couldn't traverse through 180 degrees. They were useless as defense from the land side, and their only defense was very heavy minefields. And they brought in what they called flails. They were heavy tanks with a rotating shaft in front of the tank that carried heavy chains, and these things would rotate and the chains would beat the ground and blow up the mines. They also had long tubes of explosive that could be pushed ahead. There was a mechanism on some of the tanks that would push these ahead about 100 yards right through the minefield, and they'd blow those up. And that way the defenses were destroyed, and the troops moved in and captured the guns. And thereafter, it was a matter of smoking out the troops that were fortified emplacements in the cities. Eventually, there were about 10,000 prisoners came out of Calais. I don't remember Boulogne, but Calais, I was directly involved in Calais.
Between those two cities, you happened onto an underground communication system?
That's right, yes. There was an underground telephone cable which presumably came all the way from Germany out to the north coast of Holland and Belgium and right around to the Bay of Biscay. Now, it had probably been broken further west, but one of our battalions, I think it was the Winnipeg Rifles, had set up their battalion headquarters in a small house, and they found that there was, under the basement of the house, there was a sub-basement which contained a reinforced concrete vault with a very large telephone test rack and cables with several dozen pairs coming in and going out, and they had put a phone on and they could intercept German conversation. So they called me as signal officer, and the intelligence officer and I drove over there and had a look at this thing, and sure enough we could listen to all kinds of conversations. So we sent word back to division headquarters. I wanted to get someone who knew German to sit on it and listen, but the intelligence staff at division decided it should be demolished, which we did. We cut all the cables. I hated to do it because I thought it would have been very interesting, but anyway, that destroyed their communications, but I suppose they still had radios. But in the meantime, I think the Germans were trying to evacuate their senior officers from Calais, and eventually there were only, well, there were some senior officers left when the prisoners came out. They were marched, they came out in their own accord, and then they were taken over by some of our units, and they were concentrated in an old airplane hangar about 3 or 4 miles back from Calais. And a British intelligence officer came down from 21 Army Group headquarters to interrogate some certain individuals who had been pointed out by some of the civilians. These fellows the civilians had accused them of ordering the execution of certain civilians. And so these people were separated, I don't know how they found them, but they got them out of this great mass of troops and put them in the room in a small house adjoining this old airport. And this intelligence officer interrogated them. And I happened to be along, mainly because I was with the brigade intelligence officer who was, as this was in our brigade area, he was there, so I came along. And this was a very interesting episode. because this British officer was a young man who had lived in Germany, and he was completely fluent. And he went right after those fellows and accused them of all these things and told them we were going to do away with them if they didn't confess. I don't remember the outcome. All I do remember particularly is that one of them was so agitated he had a small heart attack. But another one caved in and said, yes, he said, but I know something that's very useful to you. He said, there's a time bomb in the headquarters, in the middle of the park, in the center of the city of Calais. The Germans had built a reinforced concrete headquarters. It was mainly naval. And he said that there were there was a time bomb, and he knew where it was. And if we went down there with him, he would, with the demolition crew, we could get rid of it before it blew up. So we loaded him and other people in a two or three jeeps, and we went roaring down into the city. We went in there, but there was no time bomb. Just a lot of burning papers and an officer's mess that was stocked with the most delightful food you can imagine. Which we moved into Calais the following day and found this food. Sauerkraut, there was canned chicken, there were great tubs of butter, there were canned peas, you name it, it was there. They lived high.
How had the civilians lived in Calais?
Well, their houses were bombed and they were living from hand to mouth. Many of them had moved out, probably into the country, staying with farmers. Generally, the farmers didn't do too badly. It was people in the cities that suffered, because mainly the food supply, food and fuel. Now, of course, at that time of the year, fuel didn't matter, but I guess the winter had been pretty grim. But the port had been badly demolished. The facilities were useless as far as the port was concerned. But we only stayed there a few days and then moved on to another cleanup operation, the Scheldt Estuary in Holland. And we were there till November, I think, which that was a very tough battle. That was one of the few places where the troops actually fought hand-to-hand battles. Certainly tossing hand grenades back and forth over the Leopold Canal, which was the boundary between Belgium and Holland in that area. From then on, once that the Scheldt was cleared, then it meant that ships could come in to Amsterdam, or Antwerp, I'm sorry. One of the problems then was that the line of communications was so long that the advance was actually slowed down, mainly a supply of ammunition and fuel. For the fuel, that I think I mentioned this the other day, one of the urgent needs in clearing Boulogne was that that was to be the terminal of a pipeline which was being laid across from England, a 4-inch line on large floating reels pulled by a tugboat, which was long enough to span right across from somewhere near Folkestone, I think, to Boulogne. Once that was established, it helped, but it wasn't sufficient, and there was still a matter of ammunition and replacement vehicles and weapons and so on. So it was very important that Antwerp should be cleared. And once the Scheldt Estuary was cleared, then the ships could go in to right into Antwerp. But we also, the city of Ghent which was also dependent on the Scheldt estuary, had they were having a hard time, and they wanted the Scheldt cleared. And when it was cleared, the mayor of Ghent invited the Third Division commander, who was General Spry at that time, to bring his whole division into Ghent as guests of the city, which we did. Everyone was issued with a new uniform, and it was very well organized. Each unit moved into a certain area in the city, and we unloaded from the vehicles and lined up, and there were people there who would invite a certain number of troops to come and live in their homes. And this, the whole division was guests of the city, of the citizens. And it went very well. There were certain senior officers who shuddered at the thought of the fighting division moving into a city like that. They said, "My gosh, it will be a schmozzle. What are we going to do?" But actually, it worked out very well. I think there were only two troops who died. They drowned in the canal, staggering home from the pub. For 2 days, we were guests of a city, which was a very, very interesting and certainly a change from living in the mud. By then, it was muddy, snow. It was miserable. Then we went on to Nijmegen. The 3rd Division took over an area that had been captured by the U.S. 82nd Airborne Division and the Guards Armored Division. This was during the Bartov attack on, or at least it's immediately after the Arnhem defeat. But we took over the flat land on the Rhine and the bridge across the Rhine. There are two branches of the Rhine. This is called the Waal, I think, and then there's a, you might say, an island and another branch, which is on the Arnhem side. And so we spent all right through till early January there, and then moved on down towards the Heikwald Forest in preparation for the move into Germany. And at that time, I was transferred out of 3rd Division into what was called Army Troops Headquarters, which handled communications and line of communications area. And so from then on, it wasn't too interesting, somewhat more comfortable.
Were you happy with the change?
No, I wasn't. I would have liked to have stayed, but I was tired, and they were making changes all along the line, bringing in fresh people for the attack, the crossing of the Rhine. So we crossed the Rhine eventually, but as you might say, tourists, we moved in line of communications. Units ended up in northeast Holland. I was at a place, a little town called Utmarsum, and just on the border of Germany when the war ended. Thereafter, we gradually moved back into concentration areas.
Were you in Nijmegen?
I had been in Nijmegen, but then our last was at, I don't know whether I have, it was near, not very far from Amsterdam.
Anyway, it wasn't very far from Amsterdam, which was a pretty sad place in those days. The people had suffered terribly. I remember going into Amsterdam one day, and there had been food kitchens established throughout the city, and people would walk down to these, and some of these people were so weak from lack of food that they didn't have the strength to get there. They'd be sitting on the sidewalk waiting for help. It was a pretty sad place.
How long did you stay there for?
Well, from about mid-June to late July. I was there about a month. And then we were... it was interesting. The repatriation groups were organized according to military districts. And I was in a group, put in a group near Nijmegen. We went back near Nijmegen, and they were all people who had been recruited in Calgary, in Military District 13. And the officer commanding was a medical officer, a doctor from Calgary. And so we moved together by train to Ostend and back to Aldershot.
And Bubbles and Squeak.
Bubbles and Squeak. Well, things were better then. The food had improved very quickly after the war finished. But we were very impatient to get home, and we had thought that we'd be there for two or three days and then we'd be aboard ship and home. But as it turned out, we were there for nearly a month, or it must have been at least a month. I finally got home the first week in September.
There was a riot there?
There was a riot in Aldershot, mainly because the troops were impatient to get home. And what they had found was that the Americans, who had spent maybe a year or a year and a half overseas, were getting the first crack at the troop ships.
They were mostly American ships, weren't they?
No, they were actually mostly British ships, but they were under the Americans. See, it was the Supreme Command, ETA, Eisenhower, who was an American, and the Americans had the majority of the people in the field by then. And they had the purse strings. Have another cookie. And so we were pretty small potatoes by then, but after that riot occurred, there was some quick changes. I think it was within a week we were aboard ship, getting back to Halifax.
And you left the forces soon after that? Right after?
A month. Around a month, I think it was a month homecoming leave with pay. And I think I went to work before the month was over, because Calgary Power were building a small hydro development in the Rockies, west of Calgary, on the Kananaskis River, and they wanted me to take it on as resident engineer. So I went to work right away.
Did the Army ask you to stay in?
I had the opportunity. Everyone had the opportunity to stay, because the war ended V-Day in May, but it was August before the war ended in the Pacific, and in May it looked as though the war might go on, and everyone was given the opportunity to say yes or no. I said no, but many said yes. And those who said yes were brought home to Canada right away, and I suspect some people figured it was a way to get home. But by the time they got home, well, the war was ended in the Pacific.
Is there anything else you'd like to add, or any topic that we haven't discussed?
Well, many personal incidents. I told you the story of being a prisoner, which is probably the most interesting I remember. I learned to love England, even in wartime. Both the countryside and the people. The British people were tremendous. The way in which they took the bombing, as they always tended to joke about it more than complain. They were complaining all the time, but they were also joking about it. And this was something that that was amazing. I couldn't visualize people putting up with what they did put up with. But I suppose that that's what happens in adversity. I'm certain that the Germans put up with it just as well as the British, maybe more so, because they had, towards the end, much heavier, more constant bombing.
How did the Canadians and the English get along?
Generally, fairly well. Well, you can see the number of Canadian soldiers who married English girls. They sneered at the British, but on the whole, I think the Canadian soldiers got along well with the British. Well, so many of them had British roots, too. A lot of soldiers had distant relatives that they visited. No, I think mostly that the Canadians got along very well with the British, and I think the British appreciated the Canadians. It wasn't that way with the Americans. And, one of the difficulties was the affluence of the Americans, and they made no attempt to subdue their show of affluence. And this annoyed